This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Why are we messing around with these highly technical tools with the global food source? We need to slow down. We need to separate food out.
We often hear about the resource curse in developing countries in terms of oil or precious minerals. Most of us don't associate the concept with food. But as today's guest on Sea Change Radio, food journalist Frederick Hoffman, has chronicled, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the resource of fertile land is being exploited in a way that's reminiscent of how other marketable resources have been appropriated. Multinational companies and foreign governments are buying up mass tracts of land in poorer nations, growing food on that land, but then shipping all of it off elsewhere, depriving the populations of those countries both the resource and the profit it garnered. Kaufman explores how this reflects a change in global food security patterns and offers his take on how enormous financial institutions like Goldman Sachs are reaping profits while others starve.
Never before have I felt so good, just being natural me. Minor hang-ups and minor ties, but deep inside I'm free. So let your hair down, get down with it. Who's to say what's right or wrong? Everything I do gonna be funky from now on. Yeah,
everything I do.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Frederick Kaufman. He's a food journalist and a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Welcome back to Sea Change Radio, Fred.
Hi, Alex.
In the last part of our discussion, Fred, we talked about genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and food security and how they're linked. But that's just part of the story when it comes to the changing landscape of modern global food economics, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you just called it, Alex, you called the GMO issue a two-headed monster, one being labeling, one being biotech industry in this country in Washington, D.C. I would call it a three-headed monster because the real fate of the earth, the real fate of the food system is really going to happen in Asia and in Africa. The Chinese are deeply into genetic modification, and Africa is going to be the place where we're going to see the possibility of an entire continent being taken over by a genetic modification. America is taking actually, in terms of our eating habits, is becoming increasingly irrelevant. What is relevant is Africa and Asia at this point.
A lot of people in your industry, in the food journalism space, their eyebrows were quite raised when China bought Smithfield ham. Why don't you explain a little bit about this purchase and why it's important?
Yes. Well, what's interesting here about the purchase, the name of the company is Shuangwei, and there is even some question as to whether it's a Chinese company or not, Alex, because it's based in Hong Kong, and it's unclear also the role that Goldman Sachs has played in this multi-billion dollar sale. Clearly, they have overpaid, but it got the attention, this rapt attention of the U.S. food media with this story, China buying largest pork producer in the world. What are they buying? I mean, that's the question that that really wasn't quite answered by many of these articles. Well, it seemed obvious they're buying Smithfield ham. But what is Smithfield ham? What do they own? Well, of course, what they own is technology and pig patents. Because their pigs, of course, are their property, the kind of pig, they create these pigs, right? Mm-hmm. They hybridize them. They're their own intellectual property. And so in China, this company buys this through Goldman Sachs, this tremendous deal. What they're actually getting are intellectual property rights to our food. And so once again, we see this kind of new and strange relationship between food and money. It's not just that you're buying money to get food, you're using money to buy food. It's that you're using your money to buy intellectual property rights so that you can earn your rent off of the food.
I have a sneaking suspicion George Orwell would have really appreciated having this as an element to add to Animal Farm.
Yes, two legs bad, four legs good.
Right. So this isn't just about owning Smithfield ham and Armor sausage, and a reader of the business section, you wouldn't just see that they were buying a meat company. It's much deeper than that, in your opinion.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, once again, we can use the example of the computer industry. When Google buys a company, when Facebook buys a company, what are they buying? They're buying the intellectual property that those companies own. They're buying the proprietary software that those other companies own. And this same thing is going on in the food industry, except the software has become DNA. So when you have a large company purchasing another large food company, what is really valuable is the proprietary DNA, the proprietary patents, the proprietary intellectual property that that other food company owns, because that is what's controlling the cash flow in global food.
And I saw that this purchase was close to $5 billion. Were you able to see any analysis of how much technology was calculated for in that purchase?
Oh, I think generally people are saying it's the lion's share.
Really?
I mean, that's what they're buying.
It's not the physical plant and the slaughterhouses, and it's not the brand name of Smithfield.
In other words, what's more important is a individual slaughterhouse that was built in someplace in the Midwest, okay? Is that important, or is the plans, the temperatures, the layout, the architecture, the way in which product moves in and out, that's what you buy so that you can replicate it precisely anywhere else? It's an entire system of creating edible ham. That's what I mean by intellectual property. That's not a patent right on a DNA, but that's the intellectual property of Smithfield ham. It's their system. I mean, Tyson Foods slaughters something like 20 million chickens a week, okay? How is that even possible, right? You need incredible technology, and it's all proprietary. Well, Smithfield ham has a lot of that technology too. What China would like to do is replicate it and learn and use that technology. How does the water system work? How do the cleaning systems work? That's a big issue in China. How do the sanitary systems work? That's what they're buying.
And how does the Goldman Sachs involvement in this deal trouble you?
This is the subtitle of my most recent book, Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. When I say it stopped being food, what I mean is that it became money. That food became money, that food has attracted the interest not only of McDonald's and great food retailers and eaters across the world, but it's attracted the interest of some of the greatest moneyed forces on the planet, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Barclays Bank, Deutsche Bank. Across the board, Wall Street has perceived what the food justice people have known forever, which is that the most important elements going forward are going to be fresh water and arable land and food. Okay, and when we saw the financial crisis in 2008, really laid that bare, because that was one of the there are real. Whenever you have a crisis like this, you automatically move into like apocalyptic fear mode. That's what you see Wall Street doing. Real estate tanks. Stock market tanks, currencies themselves. Gold is through the roof because people have lost their faith in dollars and euros and pounds. And so where does the money go to? Well, it goes to gold, it goes to oil, it goes to commodities, it goes to food, it goes to, okay? And Wall Street has gone heavily into food investment. So Goldman has been onto this game ever since 1991 when they created the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, the GSCI, which was bought by Standard & Poor's in 2007. And this index, this food index, this investable food index, saw hundreds of billions of dollars of investment during the financial crisis of 2008, and it doubled and tripled the price of global food. Goldman has realized that there is a lot of money to be made in global food, and this was just a typical example of them aiding and abetting this strange company. Nobody is quite even sure what the provenance is of this company, buying Smithfield Ham and all of its attendant intellectual properties.
And Goldman's role in this was different than just being a broker, an investment bank, and brokering the deal. Did they have an investment, a stake in Smithfield Ham from the Chinese side, or were they just the deal makers? Because that's not unusual.
No, it's not unusual. How I understand it, though, is that they didn't just broker the deal. They encouraged the deal. They advised on the deal from the get-go. And so that makes it somewhat different. And their role is still a little bit unclear. They weren't just, I mean, you're right. Any deal like this needs the bankers to, when we're talking about that much money. So they were the bankers, but it's also increasingly clear that they were an impetus.
Why you baking fast? Oh, baby, honey, tell daddy why you baking fast. Now, I told you once before, baby, that's for sure, I don't go for that. In the groove, grooving for y'all at the end of out there in that land.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with food journalist Frederick Kaufman.
So are some of these bigger banks that you're talking about, like JP Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and its ilk, do they now have food desks? Are they food portfolios? Have they divided that up as a strategy because they see this as a hedge against other financial unrest?
In short, yes. Commodities, and when we mean commodities, there are really three kinds. There are the energies like oil and the precious metals like gold and silver. And then, of course, the agriculturals, which include, of course, livestock and corn and soy and wheat. These were kind of moribund investments throughout the 1980s. The commodities markets were not really moving very much. However, the bankers wanted to increase the volatility of these markets so they can make more money. You know, when you're little, you never understand when your dad tells you, for instance, gee, when the stock market goes up, the brokers make money. When the stock market goes down, the brokers make money. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because people who are professionals on Wall Street don't make money depending on the direction of stocks. That's only for suckers who actually invest. They make money on volatility. The more volatility and the more volume there is, the more money they make. So therefore, a lot of these bankers, led by Goldman Sachs, realized there was real opportunity here in the commodity sector, which was not volatile. How can we introduce a lot of volatility into this sector? And that was one of the great reasons behind the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, which was followed by many other banks.
Because they trade on the volatility itself as separate indices. I have friends who have traded the Nikkei for over a decade, but they're not trading on the Nikkei. They're trading on the volatility and the movement within that. So they're hoping that it moves within a range that they and their computer backroom geniuses have kind of devised an algorithm to figure out how much that range should be. And they're applying that to food as well, you're saying?
That's precisely it. That is precisely it, which is that these days, the trade in food futures, wheat, corn, soy, agriculture, livestock, is momentum trading, high-speed trading, computerized trading, the exact same kind of trading that is done with equities, in other words, stocks, two blocks from where I'm sitting. I live two blocks from the New York Stock Exchange, right across the street from me, basically. We're seeing high-speed trading in agricultural products. We've never seen this before. In Europe, 2 years ago, some rules came out about high-speed trading, momentum trading in food. And the law was, you won't believe this, there was a new law that came, I think it was a European, an EC rule about slowing down the trading in food commodities. And the rule was every food commodity must be held for at least 1/10 of a second. The traders were up in arms with the prospect of having to hold their positions for 1/10 of a second, Alex. I mean, what we're looking at is arbitrage is being done in the thousands of the seconds. The computers, as they have in stocks, have taken over with food. And if you can't see the inherent danger there, then we need a little sit down, right? We need
food. That's the most obvious one. I'm sure we can dig through lots of other industries that could be affected adversely by having these computer-generated trading where there's no human element at all involved.
Yeah, and you have these, right? We had the flash crash about a year and a half ago.
And the flash crash, just to, for our listeners, was just for a few minutes, or was it less than that, the Dow just plummeted, correct?
Yeah, and nobody to this day really understands how that happened or you know, where that multi-billionaire is who now lives in Bermuda, who got on the next plane out, right? These are inherently dangerous things. It's kind of like the technology is ahead of us. And this has to do with GMO to bring us back. It has to do with trading. It has to do with the law in the sense that the Supreme Court, that Wall Street regulators, that people in the biotech industry, we have these tools. We still don't quite know what to do with them. The technology is so far ahead of us. Yet at the same time, we've lost sight of very basic values, such as right to food. People need to eat. People need to eat every day. Why are we messing around with these highly technical tools with the global food source? We need to slow down. We need to separate food out. I think it's okay on a certain level to push the technology if we're talking about cell phones and sending images of people and Pinterest or whatever the latest thing is. Fine. But we're talking about global food. We're talking about something else. And we've lost our basic sense of what is important and the relationship of technology to what is important. Technology is our tool, just like markets are our tool. It's another example, Alex, which is that everybody's talking about how the market will take care of this, the market will take care of that. No, it won't. People created markets, and they created them in a very regulated way, and that's the way they work best. That's the way the commodity markets work best for hundreds of years until Goldman stepped into it, intervened, subverted it, toppled it, turned it on its head, and reaped billions of profits from it.
Is this market demand beyond the electronic trading world and the buyout world that a lot of us may not understand and glaze over when we hear, are they now applying that to real estate as well? This is, land is a resource and the food that is grown on it is a resource. So how are countries and companies preparing for that reality of food insecurity?
Well, right. This goes back to the discussion of Asia and Africa and where the global money is flowing and what will be of value going forward. Arable land. And the fact of the matter is, guess what? There is a lot of very cheap real estate in the Congo, in Ethiopia, in Rwanda and Tanzania and Uganda and Guatemala. And even though there are hungry people there, if you go in there using the methods of big agriculture, using big tractors, using genetically modified seeds, using agricultural inputs and irrigation systems and fertilizers, you can make that land yield a tremendous amount of food. I was in Ethiopia a few months back witnessing this insanely large farm, which seems to be, will be more than 1 million acres. It's in the middle of Ethiopia. It's owned by an Arab sheikh who is going to be farming basmati rice in the middle of Africa and exporting it all to Saudi Arabia. So what this guy is basically doing is using the verdant soil of Africa and the water resources of Africa and creating basmati rice for Saudi Arabia. Now, there's something wrong there when we have 13 million Ethiopians who are starving.
It seems very analogous to the medieval idea of feudalism, but this is on a global scale, really.
We have neo-feudalism. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that is what we're looking at. I mean, next door to this guy's farm is an even larger farm owned by a company called Karatani. It's an Indian company. They are the largest producer of cut roses in the world. Why there should be a million-acre farm, a high-tech farm with insane irrigation techniques and agricultural techniques to supply the world with red roses, right, when there are 13 million Ethiopians starving, well, that's beyond me, too.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with food journalist Frederick Kaufman.
How do we rectify the system, or is there a way to try to turn those local businesses in areas that are fragile into positive undertakings? I guess if you were to interview the Rose Baron of Ethiopia, he would say, well, these are good jobs for people who otherwise wouldn't be working. But there needs to be more than that when you're talking about using so much of their basic natural resources, which is their land.
One of the guys who was giving me a tour of the farm when I was down there pointed out that there would be plenty of jobs for thousands of locals because they needed a lot of weeding done.
Well, there you go.
There you have it.
So they let them eat weeds.
Yeah, let them eat weeds. But I mean, the solution in Africa, I mean, you know, Africa clearly has issues of income inequality, which dwarf our issues of income inequality. But I think what we're perceiving, and I hope what we'll perceive in this country, is that when you have increasing income inequality, when you have a virtually non-existent middle class, then when neo-feudalists go in there and they start exploiting the land, what you're actually doing is creating a situation which is going to run counter to the interests of U.S. foreign policy. You know, the one thing we don't want in the middle of Africa are the kinds of Islamic revolutions that have happened in the northern part of Africa or the Middle East. I mean, if that doesn't convince people in Washington that we need to be more sensitive to the requirements of middle class and lower middle class people in African nations, I don't know what will. But we seem to not really understand that very basic connection between food, money, middle class purchasing power.
And these aren't just private companies that are undertaking this. There's governments that are leading this charge as well in this neo-feudalism land grab, correct?
Yeah, and also there are, you know, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. They're bad players here because they, how do they perceive development? I mean, this word is so charged, Alex.
It's like privatization in the 90s. That sounded great. I like privacy.
Yeah, we love development, don't we? Well, how do we measure development? Well, we have these kind of very basic Wall Street-type measurements of development. How much foreign exchange is there? How much for export is there? These really kind of throwback mercantilist perceptions of what it means to be quote-unquote good and quote-unquote on the right track. And so what you do, for instance, in Ethiopia is if you come in, you want to develop, well, what you do is you bring in a lot of foreign exchange. Ah, the World Bank and the IMF, jing jing, they see that. And you say, and the sheikh says, and guess what? Everything I make here in this country is for export. Well, how absurd and awful for the Ethiopians. But once again, the IMF and the World Bank are like, jing jing, jing jing. Wow, the export numbers are going up. we should give these guys more loans.
So there's not even the veil of a colonialistic state that, let's say, England and India may have had in the early part of the 20th century and the late 19th century, where at least they were, quote unquote, trying to civilize these savages, right?
But you know what's even more pathetic? What's even more pathetic is that the U.S. is so bad at this game, is that the Indians, the people from India and the people from China, the business from China, they're kicking our butts. They're kicking our butts in Africa. They're going out there. They're making the bribes they have to make. They're doing their capitalism. They're out-capitalizing the capitalists.
So we need to jump into this game, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess we need to be better exploiters, obviously.
Obviously. This is a very clever Trojan horse strategy that's much more effective than using guns. This is using dollars.
Look, since World War II, the United States foreign policy has understood very clearly that food can be a very helpful tool, both domestically and internationally. Domestically, we get to export food, we get to support farmers, we get to give them subsidies. And all of a sudden, giving food to countries that need food, wow, we just got on their good side. But the whole nature of development has changed. There is that idea of sending huge boatloads of wheat from this country to other parts of the world, that's completely outmoded. The oil costs too much. And so therefore, there's new thinking, which is that we need to develop the resources within the countries that are in most need of development. But what happens then again and again and again is that those countries actually are countries which are victims of devastating income inequality. And so the people who already have a lot of money and education are the ones who actually get all the benefits of that development. And the ones who don't are left as they were before.
Lester Brown wrote a piece in the Futurist on long-distance farming and the impacts of it. He didn't really address a lot of the possible solutions, but can you give us a hint in where you think there may be some kind of ways to try to solve this problem, or is this the road we're going down?
Well, Lester Brown is one of my heroes, and you know, without his work, I couldn't be doing my work. I think that when we're looking at solutions, we're looking at, once again, very basic, what can we do to help the quote-unquote smallholder in these developing countries? In other words, the people, most of them are women, most of these farmers are women, who are farming maybe less than 10 acres of land, maybe even less than 5 acres. What kind of systems can we put in place to allow them to store more grain, allow them to sell their grain at a better price, to allow them to bring their goods to market more efficiently? I mean, there's no quote-unquote killer app for food. Probably the one killer app for ending hunger is increasing women's education. Not a very sexy topic, Alex, but what we find again and again and again is that in countries where women are educated, there is less hunger. An educated woman is maybe less apt to have more than 10 children, you know? And so that's something that's important, women's education. Breastfeeding education, you know, instead of incredible plumpy nut candy bars for kids, how about education and breastfeeding? You know, this is a good anti-hunger technology the last time I checked, right? And so these are very positive things that can be done, but once again, they're not necessarily things which are getting the attention of the Bill Gates Foundation. We have great farming in this country. Why? Because we have this very long history of government intervention in farm education. We have all these land grant schools, right? We have all these technical schools. We have all these, you know, A&M schools. We have hundreds of years of history teaching people how to be farmers.
Food journalist Frederick Kaufman. Fred, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lee Dorsey, Taj Mahal, and U2.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.